So let's see. So I will have to cut some material off, and I need to think which one. But I think it's good that we keep asking questions. So what we were saying is that we have the ground states of local Hamiltonians in 1, 2, 3 dimensions. They obey this area law. So the entropy that we find in a region is not proportional to the size of the region, but to the size of the boundary of the region. And so this is in contrast with a generic state. In a generic state, the entropy attached to a region is proportional precisely to the size of the region. Okay? And now I want to ask you a question again. So if we look at these two, and you know, there is some color coding going on here, right? Red, red, blue, blue. But I still want to ask you a question. If we look at a region and the Smith decomposition between that region and the rest of the system, what type of Smith coefficients do you expect when we have a generic state? Okay? Do you expect a sharp distribution or a flat distribution? Flat. Why? Apart from the color coding.
Well, because the generic state has high entropy to get that flat distribution.
Okay. And instead, for ground states, what we're going to be seeing is these sharp distributions, these sharply falling distributions. Okay. So the area law, we will be talking area law here, area law there. That's just a way of talking about this other thing that is happening behind the scenes, which is that when you Smith decompose your wave function into some region and the rest, you'll see that the Smith coefficients are decaying very fast, and you can throw away actually most of them. Okay? Yes?
Is there any intuitive reason for why the area law works?
Not intuitive enough that would be useful here at this point. But we want to think that it's the result of asking. You know, a local Hamiltonian is a set of local constraints, and you ask the wave function to minimize all those local constraints, right? It's the ground state. So the result of asking these local constraints are frustrated. So you know, this Hamiltonian term does not commute with this other Hamiltonian term. So you cannot fulfill, you cannot get individually to the ground state of each Hamiltonian term, but globally you try to get an average. You know, try to lower the energy as much as possible, and the result is this area law. I know this is not satisfactory at this point, but that's just think of this as a result of the locality of the Hamiltonian.
So you want to use matrix product state to find the ground state. But why are you already talking about the ground state? And so you found it with some other method?
Yes, but I cannot talk about this today. Yes. So I'm not discussing how to find this. I'm just pointing out that ground states have a property, okay, that doesn't depend on whether we are talking about the Ising model or the Heisenberg model, or all ground states have this property.
So is it a law or an empirical law?
Right. some people made it up.
I feel that's not quite hard.
Okay. So I can build counterexamples. So it's a rule, general rule that is useful because it tells you what happens generically or most of the time when you deal with ground states. Yes. Questions?
But really, you should do the Smith decomposition.
Yes.
And find out.
Yes.
Okay, can you build counterexamples with local Hamiltonians?
You can. Yes, people do that. Just because they see other people saying, oh, there is an area law, then they go, no, you can, you know, here's a counterexample, here's another counterexample. But yeah. So it's a useful, very useful rule. You have to really go crazy with your Hamiltonian to go away from the rule. Okay? So you can engineer artificially some Hamiltonian that will not, such that the ground state will not fulfill the rule, a local Hamiltonian that such that the ground state violates the area law, but that is not the type of Hamiltonian you care, usually. Okay, very good. So, and when I say area law, I'm simplifying. There is a little correction sometimes there, and it's a logarithmic correction. So, actually, for for ground states of critical Hamiltonians in one dimension, instead of having an area law, we'll find a logarithmic correction. So what's going to be relevant today is that for gap Hamiltonians, we'll have the area law, meaning in one dimension. So now we specialize to one dimension. In one dimension, the area law says the entropy is a constant independent of the size of the region. But if we had the critical system, okay, if the Hamiltonian was at the quantum critical point, then the ground state entropy would grow as the logarithm of the size of the region. Okay, it's still much smaller than growing as the size of the region. It's just a log as opposed to L. Okay, good. So now I would like to explain to you a very simple toy model that is compatible with the area law. So when you hear about area law, you can think, oh yeah, toy model. So imagine we have a maximal entangled state between two spins. This is the 1 over square root of 2, 1, 1 plus 2, 2. If we Schmidt decompose this, we've done it before, we get 2 1 halves. And so if we compute the entropy, it's a 1. Okay. Now imagine that we have that part A and part B are sharing two such singlets, or such maximal entangled states. So when we now Schmidt decompose between left and right, we'll get that the spectrum is two copies of that, so the product of two, and so we get 1/4 times 4 times. Okay? So this is a new distribution, and if we compute the entropy instead of being 1, now it's 2. But it makes sense, right? We had twice as much entanglement as before. So in general, you see where this is going. If we have n of those, okay, so we have the left and the right parts of share this n copies of an entangled state of this form. Then if we make a cut, if we have a Schmidt decomposition of this the whole wave function between left and right, what we have is that the Schmidt coefficients in this case are 1 over 2 to the n, and we have 2 to the n of those. Okay. So in this case, the entropy is n times the entropy of just having one. This makes sense, right? We are just adding copies. So the entanglement entropy is additive over this number of copies. OK, so now I want to discuss a silly, really silly model where I'm going to think that I have a lattice made of sides. And on each side, I have two spin 1/2. OK, so each side here, each blue dot here, it's a side with two spin 1/2. And it's in a state, which is going to be my toy model for ground states, which is just this. There are two spins here. One is entangled with the neighboring side. The other spin is entangled with the other neighbor. Okay. So this is a very simple wave function. Okay. It's a wave function that only have correlations to nearest neighbors, because this side here is not correlated with this one directly, only through intermediate steps. Okay. So it's a shortly correlated wave function. The two-point correlators are zero as once you go beyond nearest neighbors. And it's just a toy model. Okay? But I hope it's clear. It's just this pair of spins entangled to nearest neighbors. OK, so this is a wave function. And now I can ask, how much entropy do I have in region A when I trace out the rest? Okay, but we just discussed that what we have in region A is connected to the rest of the system through two pairs, right? So if we Schmidt decompose this wave function between A and the rest, region A and the rest, what we have is that there are two entangled pairs connecting region A and the rest. Okay. So the total entropy is going to be one from this side and one from that side. So the entanglement entropy of this region is 2. Okay. So now we have this other region. Let's consider that we change the size of the region. And I have a question for you. How much is the entropy going to be in this case? How much? I've heard a 2. Why is it 2?
Because it's still connected with just one pair on one side and one pair on the other side.
Very good. So we only need to worry about what's happening near the boundary of our interval, right? That starts to sound like an area law, right? So this goes on, okay? Doesn't matter how large your region is. The entanglement is always coming from the boundary. Okay? Very good. So that's the area law in one dimension. So this silly toy model already gives you some intuition about what the area law, where the area law is coming from. It's coming from the short distance entanglement that is coupling your region with the rest of the system. All right, so we could do the same in two dimensions, and I have to cut materials, so I'm just going to go a bit faster here. But I've built a similar toy model. Now each side has four spins, and this side has an entangled spin with its nearest neighbor. So now I can ask, how much entanglement do I have in this case if I have, yeah, in the region A? Okay?
Eight.
Yes. Okay? We just need to cut a number of spins, which is eight, entangled pairs, which is eight. Good. And now? 16. I was faster. So again, you just need to count how many pairs you have. Okay. But you see what's happening here. It's the area law, because the number in any dimensions, you can build these models in any dimension. You entangle your sides with nearest neighbor sides, and now you try to cut the region out. And how many singlets do you have to cut? How many entangled pairs do you need to cut? Well, a number proportional to the size of the boundary of your region, not proportional to the size of the region itself. Okay? So we have the area law. And then there are logarithmic corrections, and this is where I said I'm going to cut something. Well, if there are, at the critical systems, what you have is that it's not enough to just count local short distance entanglement, that you have to count also longer distance entanglement. You do the numbers, you do the drawings, and you get the logarithmic correction. And I'm afraid that I have to move to the second lecture. Sorry, questions? Oh, yeah, here. There was another lecture, I think. Right. All right. So we've been talking about quantum spin change for longer than I should. Now we go back to the partition function. Okay? We've seen that there is an area law and a toy model that kind of gives you an intuition of what's happening. So we want to repeat the same for partition functions. All right, so partition functions, we've been talking about them. It's just a sum, a weighted sum of over configurations where the weights are given by the Boltzmann weights. Okay. So we're back to a classical system. We have classical spins only. Okay. So now what I want to justify is that we can take this partition function and write it as a tensor network. So what's important about the partition function, again, is that it's a product of Boltzmann weights, and that these Boltzmann weights, actually, if the Hamiltonian is sum of local terms, the Boltzmann weights themselves are the product of local Boltzmann weights. Okay? So to decide the Boltzmann weight for a full configuration, it's just the product of Boltzmann weights for individual pairs of spins. Okay. So what we can do, and for instance, just for the Ising model, right? The Boltzmann weight, local Boltzmann weight for two nearest neighbors, spin near two neighboring spins, would be just the exponential of beta sigma, the sigma for one spin, so the product of the two spins. Okay, so this looks like a matrix to me. I'm a bit biased. I see matrices everywhere, but this one. Actually, what we're saying is that each spin can be up or down, right? You have two spins, and each spin can be up or down. So let's use the first spin as one index, the second spin as the other index, two options and two options. That's a matrix, right? We have four options. We can write it as a matrix. We can have up, up, down, down, up, down, down. And these are the coefficients inside the matrix. So the Boltzmann weights involving two spins can be organized as a matrix. Okay? Very good. So it turns, what we're saying then is that if you want to understand the weight of a given configuration, of a given configuration of n spins, you have to choose which entry is the relevant one on those matrices. But we don't want to do that. What we want to do is we want to take this matrix and manipulate it a little bit. Here is some decomposition you can perform. You can break it into, so our matrix local Boltzmann weight W, right? This just this matrix W for the Ising model. We can write it as a product of two matrices of M matrix M and M transpose. Okay? This, ultimately, you can derive generically with single value decompositions and so on. But for this particular case, it's so easy that I just wrote it here for you. Okay? We can write a matrix M such that M, M transpose give rise to this Boltzmann-Weight matrix. Okay? So what we're going to do is, first we define the matrices for the Boltzmann weights, and then we decompose this matrix as the product of M, M transpose. And finally, I'm going to define a tensor by putting together four of these matrices. Okay? So I can multiply these four matrices together, perform a sum over one of the indices, and I'll get a tensor. Okay? And this is not magic. I mean, this is just a set of instructions. You'll be implementing this afternoon. It's a piece of cake. Okay? It's linear algebra. But there is nothing mysterious about it. Now, what I want to do is I want to repeat these steps, but for the full partition function. So now, so far I was considering a single spin. I said we could do things about the Boltzmann weights of a single pair. So now here's the partition function, how it looks. Okay, this is a partition function for 3 times 3 spins. So your lattice has 9 spins. Yes?
Yeah, just interrupting. So when you have a cross of these lines, that means that there is one index the same for all four?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yes. I was going to say this now. Yes, very good. But you're right. You're right. No? You're right. So I want to convince you that this is how the partition function looks like. Okay, but this is nothing new. I mean, so what are these? So we have a square lattice. Ignore the circles for now, and you just look at the vertices. And here we have a spin sigma. Okay, here we have another spin sigma. So the spins are sitting on the vertices. And now what I'm saying is that on each edge between, say, this spin and this spin, there is a Boltzmann weight. Okay. And this Boltzmann weight, how much it is, it depends on how much this spin is. This could be plus or minus 1. This could be plus or minus 1. And once we decide how much this spin is, plus or minus 1, and this, we look at the matrix. We look at the element in the matrix, and we say, OK, that's the Boltzmann weight. Okay. So I just rewrote the partition function. I didn't do anything else. I haven't computed anything. I just rewrote the partition function as a product of the Boltzmann weights. At this point, we're still doing the same as Monte Carlo. I mean, we're doing nothing. I don't mean that Monte Carlo doesn't do anything. I'm saying that we're setting up the problem. Okay. Now, in Monte Carlo, what can we do? Well, we can go spin by spin, okay, and decide, okay, let's sample over configurations of the spins. Every time I decide on a configuration, all these matrices turn into numbers. Okay. This matrix turns into a particular entry here. If the two spins are up, I pick up this element. If the two spins are down, I pick up these elements. If one is up and the other down, I pick up one of these elements. Okay? So this is the same that you saw in the first lecture this morning. Or it's, you know, a weird way of writing the partition function as you saw it this morning. And now I'm going to do something different. I'm just going to remember that this matrix can be broken into two pieces, M and M transpose. Okay. So and that M times M transpose gives you this. You can just check. Okay, it's a 2 times 2 matrix multiplication, and then remember what the cosh is in terms of the exponential. Okay, so I'm gonna make the replacement everywhere in here. This is my partition function. Oh, by the way, sorry. There are 3 spins, 1, 2, 3. And this guy here is this weight. Okay, so there are periodic boundary conditions. That's the mysterious gray circle here. It means it's this guy already. Okay, periodic boundary conditions in the horizontal direction and also in the vertical direction. Okay, very good. So let me make the replacement. Let me replace each single Boltzmann matrix by the product of M transpose. Okay, and you get something like that. Okay. So just replace, and then finally we'll multiply groups of 4 tensors, or 4 matrices, into a tensor. Okay, and we'll get this tensor network. Okay, where again this index is contracted with this index, and so on, this with this. So this is, again, the torus topology. So I want to insist that these are operations that are very simple, and you will have a chance to check how simple they are this afternoon when you implement them. And the idea is that we end up with a tensor network, okay, exact representation for the partition function. So on the torus, explicitly, I will have to draw this, which I have not been drawing, just to imply that we have periodic boundary conditions in the vertical and horizontal directions. Okay? Is it clear that this is just a representation of the partition function? Okay, one person said yes, that's good. So if we had a larger lattice, we would just put more tensors. But all these tensors are the same, are the result of these basic operations. Okay? Take the Boltzmann weight, Boltzmann matrix, break it into two pieces, put together four of those. Okay? So that's the partition function. Again, this is an exact representation. It's an exact representation of the partition function. Now, we haven't done anything, and we haven't gained anything either. Because if we were to try to compute, you know, to multiply all these tensors together to extract how much the partition function is, well, the cost of doing that is exponential. Okay? So we wouldn't be able to do it. Okay? Not exactly, at least. We cannot exactly contract, manipulate all this and get exactly Z. So, but we can perform an approximate contraction, or we can approximately compute this object. And one strategy at this point could be equivalent to Monte Carlo. We could start sampling over these indices. Okay? What we are going to do is something else, and we'll see exactly how to do it tomorrow. It's called tensor renormalization group. We're going to actually not sample over configurations. We'll take all of them into account. Okay? We'll have a parallel computation of all the amplitudes, but we'll have to compress them in some way, and this compression will come with a small compression error. Okay? But you will see that for away from criticality, this compression error is very, very small. Okay? And the question I want to address in the next 20 minutes this is I want to try to understand, why should this strategy succeed? Why should we be able to coarse grain all these amplitudes and obtain an approximation? Okay, and we're back to singular value decompositions. So this is my tensor, the single tensor, okay, the result of locally manipulating the Boltzmann weight. So this is the starting point. And now we could ask, what if I singular value decompose it? What if I break this tensor into two? Okay? By putting these two indices together and these two indices together. Remember, once I put these two indices together and these two together, this is a matrix, and I can apply a singular value decomposition. So I could do that. This is the result, okay, of the singular value decomposition. Now, this index is going to run, if this each index here runs over two values, this is going to run over four values. You can check that. Now, I would like to see also what happens if I singular value decompose this block of tensors. So now we have four tensors. But if I join these four indices and those four indices, this again is a matrix, and I can singular value decompose it. Okay? And if I try to do that, well, I'll break this whole thing as a product of two tensors. But what I see is that this index here is growing a lot. Now it takes 2^4 values. Okay? And I can do that for a bigger block. And again, what I'm trying to do is I'm getting a chunk of this tensor network that I want to compress or to compute, to contract altogether. I'm taking a chunk and I'm trying to see whether there is something, some small parameter I can truncate. Okay? I'm trying to identify, you know, this is a complex object. I'm trying to explore what is it that I can cut and make it simpler. Okay? So the trick is to look at these decompositions. You take a big chunk of tensors and you try to break them into two pieces by a singular value decomposition. Okay? And this is looking really bad, because every time I try this with a bigger chunk of the tensor network, I get that the singular value decomposition requires more and more singular values. How many? Well, actually, if this were coarse grained steps, if I'm just, you know, considering one times one, two times two, four times four, it turns out that in these steps, the number of Schmidt values that I need to consider is growing. Not exponentially, no, doubly exponentially, okay? This is the worst thing I've seen today. Okay, so doubly exponentially. Okay. This is really bad. We're not going anywhere with this. Okay? So yeah. The big question is, can we truncate these guys? Can we have a look at these single values and identify that for some reason they can be made, you know, they can be simplified? So if I had 2 to the 2L or whatever equals singular values, every time I truncate a bit, I lose a bit. Okay? If I truncate away half of my singular values, I lose half of my partition function. That's not the way to go. But if for some reason the singular values were like this, it's the same story as before. Okay? We would be able to remove some of them, lots of them perhaps, and not change essentially the partition function. Okay? So that's the idea. So in practice, when you will try, you'll be experimenting with this afternoon, you'll get you build this gang of tensors together, and you'll try to split it, and you'll see that actually you can throw away a lot of singular values, right? They decay very sharply. And the question is why? I mean, okay, so tomorrow we'll be exploiting this to compute the partition function, but now we would like to understand why. And that may work. So again, what we can do, there is some hidden area law going on again. And to try to understand it, it's useful to introduce a toy model. Okay? So what I want you to imagine is that we are not at a critical point, but far away from a critical point, such that the correlations in your partition function are local. Right? You have exponential decay of correlations with a very small correlation length. So two spins that are far away are essentially not correlated. Two spins that are very close, they are still correlated. Okay? So this will be represented as a toy model by this corner double line tensor. And what this is simply a tensor where the indices decompose each index. So this tensor has four indices, 1, 2, 3, and 4. But each of the indices decomposes in 2. And the indices are only correlated to nearest neighbors, so to say. Okay, so it's in words, well, in a mathematical expression, what we're saying is that we break index alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, as the product of 2 alphas, 2 betas, 2 gammas, and 2 deltas. And then each, say, alpha 2 is only talking to beta 1, beta 2 is only talking to gamma 1. So this is how the correlations go in the system. This index is uncorrelated from this index, and so on.
Why
now,
is it DLC?
Sorry?
Why is it DLC?
Oh, corner double line? CDL, yeah. DLC, wow. yeah. I don't want. It was Father's Day yesterday, and I wasn't a very good father. I was preparing this. Good. So it should be CDL, no? CDL. Very good. So these CDL tensors, if we have the full partition function made, or this tensor network representing the partition function, if it's made of tensors that decompose in this way, then what you see is this drawing, but let me tell you what this drawing means. Okay? So remember that each tensor here originally corresponds to a spin. We did many things. We broke the Boltzmann weights, this and that. But in the end, each tensor here comes originally from a spin. Okay? And so when we have this type of tensor network, where each tensor decomposes in this way, which is, I insist, just a toy model, what we find is that the spin, this spin and that spin, okay, this spin here and this spin here, which are sitting here and here, they will be correlated because there is some leg connecting them. Okay, there is this circle. But this spin, the same spin, and that spin down here, which is this one here. So if we look at correlations between these two spins, now in this toy model partition function, these two spins are not correlated at all, because there is no line directly connecting the two of them. Okay? All the lines, all the correlation lines start here and go around and come back. Okay? So this really is a partition function that only represents very short range correlations. But this is all we need. Remember that when we had a wave function with singlet pairs of states, this also was only nearest neighbor entanglement. Right? So that's the partition function version of that, only nearest neighbor correlations. All right, so now let's try to single value decompose this guy. And the question is, how many legs do we need to break? How many green legs we need to break to separate these indices from those indices, OK? And when you look at the structure of the tensor, you see, OK, two. Good. Now, when we try to do the same, the singular value decomposition between the upper these indices and those indices, now we have this. And now I want to ask, how many green legs do we need to break? Okay? And it looks bad because there are many legs in between. Okay? Many lines, green lines going. But and it gets even worse when we go to bigger sizes. But here's the thing. This thing, this circle, inner circle, it just, if you remember where it's coming from, it's just a trace. Okay? It's just a number. It, from the perspective of the outer legs, it plays no role. It's just a number that you can compute and extract. Okay? So what that means is that we can delete all these inner legs. Okay? And now we can ask the question again. How many green legs do I need to break to separate these indices, so these indices, from these indices, those indices? And now I can ask the question. Two, right? And two. It's a number that, again, is independent of the size of the region. Okay? So this is really the area law for partition functions, the same principles that work for the quantum systems. All right, so this is the answer. We can break these big pieces by just keeping a very small number of singular values. It's the same number all the time. Doesn't matter how large the pieces of partition function are. Okay, so what we probably, because the toy model decides that we realize that what's happening is that the boundary, the only thing that counts when we want to analyze how to break this big thing into two pieces, is what's happening at the boundary of this big object. Okay, and this boundary, if you think about it, looks like it's drawn in a way that it looks like the one-dimensional quantum system we had before. This could be the ground state, the toy model for the ground state of a spin chain with periodic boundary conditions. Okay? So this is not a silly analogy. This is what's going on there. Because whenever you have a partition function in 2D, if you start cutting pieces, or if you cut a strip, you have a transfer matrix of a quantum system in one less dimension. Okay? So this is really what's happening. There is this. Both ground states and partition functions are organized in such a way that the locality of either the quantum Hamiltonian or the classical Hamiltonian manifests itself, okay, through the correlations. There is a very concrete, very particular structure of correlations. And here I've been talking about the Ising model, but I've been drawing stuff without referring explicitly to the Ising model for anything. And that's because this is true generically. You can think about the Ising model is the simplest Ising model, but you can now, you know, you can remember, oh yeah, I'm here because of quantum gravity. So you can start thinking about more complex partition functions. And if you were to analyze those partition functions in the same way, you would find the same, that there is some area law capturing the structure of correlations. Okay. Good. Questions? Yes.
Isn't that a statement which depends on the locality? That you just have like the degrees of freedom locally interacting?
Very good. So do you say that because in quantum gravity you don't have this property? What I meant to say is that in practice, in quantum gravity, sometimes you end up writing your constraints and your you end up having the equivalent of Boltzmann weights, but not for Ising model up down, but a much more complicated structure. Maybe there are gauge constraints, you know, simplicity. I don't know. You have all these words. Yeah. I've heard you guys. So all these things are local constraints. Local. These are properties that you can enforce through something that is generalized Boltzmann weight. Okay? But this is local still. And once you have this degree of locality, you could go and take your partition function and have a look from this perspective, and you would see the same properties arising. Okay? Okay. And I don't remember. Oh, yeah, good.
Is the real property that you need the fact that the Gibbs state has a finite correlation length? And the short range interaction is just a way to enforce that?
Very good. So I also had a toy model for gapless systems, critical systems in the quantum case, which I had to go fast over. And in this case, what that would mean is that maybe if you are at criticality, so if you don't have a finite correlation length but a diverging correlation length, maybe what's going to happen is that there won't be just one contribution, but more. But remember, there was a logarithmic contribution. It was logarithmic versus linear. So it's still a small, so it's a correction to this picture. There will be a correction to this picture. But the amount of correction is going to be moderate compared to the, you know, the double exponential that I was talking before about. Okay? So the critical case is going to be harder. But it's still going to benefit from the same ideas. Okay? The fact that there is some area law, maybe with a logarithmic correction. Okay? So this is all there. It's been in your favorite partition function since ever, and we're just trying to, you're learning to exploit it. But it's not a property, you know, this is a property of the original partition function. And what I'm trying to do is open your eyes to that property, because from a computational perspective, it's a very useful thing to know. Okay? So tomorrow we'll see specifically how to compute the partition function exploiting this property. Very good. Yes?
Sorry, I'm not exactly sure how much you lose and how that relates to the Schmidt decomposition values. So what is your error that you get from this?
Yes. So we wanted to, right, so you will be answering this question this afternoon. You'll be computing these things and seeing the Schmidt decomposition, saying, oh, if I cut here, I lose that much. Therefore, it's OK. Or, you know, today I won 10 digits of accuracy, so I have to cut a bit farther down. But that's still OK. OK? Very good. So I was just going to, yeah, this is just illustrating that this is a 1D quantum system in disguise at the boundary. So I would just repeat myself, and I'm running out of time. And I don't remember what else I wanted to say, so let me check. Yeah, critical systems, there are corrections. OK, so what I was saying a moment ago is that in a critical system, there will be contributions coming from different length scales, so it's going to be slightly more complicated, but still it's going to be fine. OK, and I think I want to use the last 2 minutes to just summarize what we've seen and see where we're going tomorrow. So I started with a long detour through quantum spin change. I wanted to talk about partition functions, say the Ising model in two dimensions, but instead I talked about the quantumizing model in one dimension. We've been discussing about entanglement, and you may wonder what's entanglement. Well, entanglement is a property of quantum systems, not of classical systems. Then singular value decompositions, area law, and then some toy models for this area law for quantum entanglement in ground states. Okay? And the reason why I did this is because there is a translation of every of these properties from quantum systems in 1D to partition functions in 2D. Right, in two dimensions. And so this was very schematic. You saw many drawings. This afternoon, the goal is to make this concrete. Okay? We'll take the Ising model partition function. We'll find these 2 × 2 metrics corresponding to the Boltzmann weights. We'll break it into two pieces. We'll multiply it into some blue ball tensor, right? The tensor which was a blue ball with 4 legs. Okay? And we'll start manipulating those tensors, and we'll see that some of the things I told you are actually true. And this will be the basis for tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll exploit all these properties to compute the partition function, okay, for very large systems, maybe 1,000 × 1,000 spins in a couple of minutes with your laptop, and away from criticality. At criticality, it's going to be more complicated. And then I will also discuss how this way of thinking, of course, learning a tensor network, may generate a renormalization group flow. Okay. So it's lunch time? Okay.
Until 2, we meet again at 2 here for the tutorials.
So I know lunch is important. Clément, what's happening with Julia? So there was some Julia notebooks sent to you at some point, some instructions?
Not yet.
Oh, more exciting. Okay, so what the language we'll be using is Julia. Okay, it's a free access, blah, blah, blah. Very, very nice. But you need to install it. And please don't come to the tutorial without having installed Julia in your laptop. If you need help, we're here. Okay, so talk to Clément, talk to me, IT. But do it before the lecture. Question?
Does that mean that we should not rely on using the Jupyter environment online?
Jupyter, yeah, that should be fine, no? Yeah, Jupyter, if you know about.
So we don't need to install it, we can just go to the Jupyter.
If you know how to use it, yes.
You mean the PA one? There's a website where you can watch it.
Thank you.
The Julia environment.